Hello and welcome to the fourth night of Millennial 8. There will be four streams as usual tonight. There has been a slight scheduling change. It will be, hold on a second, it will be Jeffrey Bale and Tamir Baron in 2 hours from now, then Pete Quinone, then Red Ice. But first, I have a very popular guest. He appeared once before, 2 years ago, and lots of people really enjoyed it. It was a bit of a roller coaster conversation. And it is Godfrey Bloom, who is a British-English politician, a former MEP, and, well, many other things. And he has his own YouTube channel and Odyssey channel. So he's a very busy man. Godfrey, welcome back to Millennial.
A great pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Right, excellent. Godfrey, I should say, what was due to appear last year, but illness precluded that. So I'm very glad that he's able to appear this year. Quite a few people were disappointed because he's a popular guest. So yeah, very glad to have you back, Godfrey. And this year hasn't been as when you were on before. It was the end of 2020, and that was an incredible year. In various ways, the COVID was a huge thing, and the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd in America, all of that, and then the U.S. election. But 2022 has been noteworthy in other ways, especially the Ukraine war. As a military strategist and historian, I'm sure you have quite a lot to say about this. What would you say about the Ukraine war? What is the situation there? What is going on? Can you explain the war for the uninitiated?
Certainly. It's a great shame that we don't have broader coverage of this conflict so people could be fully informed. At the moment, people aren't fully informed about how this started, why it started, and what's happening at the moment. And that is a great shame. The propaganda, which is largely run by deep state, the neocons in Washington, and our vassal state, which we are when it comes to Washington in this country, have persuaded people through their relentless propaganda that Putin woke up one morning bored as stiff in February, didn't know what to do. He wanted to just have some fun, and he needlessly invaded the Ukraine. Just to keep himself busy. And this is what most people think. 85% of the population in this country actually believe that to be true. It is, of course, totally absurd. Let's just take it back to 2014. 2014, the CIA overturned the elected government in the Ukraine, who was very much more peace-orientated and certainly more friendly towards Russia from a geopolitical strategy point of view. The CIA overturned that because Washington is interested in regime change in the Russian Federation. So this is about regime change wanted by the Americans. It's just the same as Libya, Iraq, the Horn of Africa, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Grenada. I mean, I could go on and on and take up the whole program of countries that have been invaded by the Americans on the basis of regime change. They want the same in the Russian Federation. They want to destroy the Russian Federation, and that's really what they want to do. Now, that takes us to the situation we are now in. Now, the Russian Federation simply wanted to put in specialist forces, a surgical expedition, to protect the ethnic Russians in the east of the Ukraine, in Donbass. That's what they wanted, which have been gratuitously attacked and murdered since 2014. And this has been going on, costing thousands of ethnic Russian lives. And the Russian Federation have actually said, look, we made a deal when the collapse of the Soviet Union came about. We made a deal. There was no need for NATO. And NATO said, we won't expand NATO. And of course, they've reneged on that. They pushed NATO right up to the Russian border in the Baltic, including Latvia, Estonia, and the Baltic countries. They pushed through NATO membership for Poland and Romania, and so it's pushed right up to the Russian border. And the Russian Federation have said, just a minute, this wasn't the deal. You've pushed it further and further. And of course, for NATO, read America. So we now have a situation where there are American missiles and boots on the ground in Poland and Romania and the Baltic Republics. And Liz Truss, the foreign secretary, went out to speak to Putin when she was foreign secretary. And Putin said, we will not tolerate 1,000 kilometers of border in the Ukraine with American troops and American missiles. We won't tolerate that thus far and no further. And she came back, and Putin then made the announcement that she just wasn't listening. Liz Truss just wasn't listening. And he said, then I made it absolutely clear. I made it absolutely clear that we wouldn't tolerate this. And so he tried to launch a surgical arrangement with specialist troops to protect the east of Donbass and secure Crimea, which has been Russian, of course, for nearly 400 years. This was a mistake by Putin because he didn't realize, or he didn't think, that the NATO, led by America, would go to the extent that they have by pouring in weapons and billions of dollars. I think it's now nearly $100 billion to prop up the Ukrainian army. He didn't think they'd do that. So what he did, he made a tactical strategical withdrawal back towards the east and the north in Belarus, and with a view to building up his forces to actually defeat the Ukrainian army in the field. And this has always been the Russian military tactic. They don't care about space or people. They have space. Russia is absolutely vast. And this is how the Russians defeated Napoleon and Hitler's invasion, by letting them come on and on and on with extended lines of communication and then fight the weather. The Russians have done this again. They've withdrawn and withdrawn and withdrawn. And it's their job now, having with this build up, to bring the Ukrainian army to battle and destroy the Ukrainian army, which is what they're going to do. And you'll see that happen in the next 2 or 3 months. And the Ukrainian army will be totally and utterly destroyed. None of this needed to happen. It's a totally unnecessary war. It could have been easily solved. There was peace on the table 2 months ago when the Russian Federation said, look, if we neutralize the Ukraine, we don't want Russian, we don't want American troops in here. We'd like it to be neutral, Ukraine to be neutral. And we'd like protection for the Russian ethnics in the east of the Ukraine, in the Donbass region. And that's all the Russians want. The Russians don't want to take over the Ukraine. They just want to consolidate the protection of the ethnic Russians in the east and consolidate the Crimea. Now, this has been done and can be done by plebiscite. The people in the Crimea want to remain part of the Russian Federation. They've already voted 95% to do that. The people in the Donbass have said, we'd like to be part of we'd like the protection of the Russian Federation. So this war is unnecessary. What we could have easily done is said, why don't we let the people decide where they want to be? Let the people in the West, who are Ukrainian and Ukrainian speaking, let them stay where they are, be what they want to be. They're happy. Let the people in the East decide that they want the Russian Federation, be part of the Russian Federation, and we'll have a plebiscite and it can be internationally monitored. Now, here's a funny thing. We did it with Scotland a few years ago, and quite rightly, there was a pressure for Scottish independence, and we said, the country said, Great Britain said, the United Kingdom said, this is perfectly rational if they want to do this, and the fairest way of doing this is to have a referendum and let Scotland go independent if they want, and if they don't, they don't. That's fine. We could quite easily do the same thing in the Ukraine. Where do you want to live? Do you want to live in the Russian Federation in Donbass? Or do you want to live in the Ukrainian in the West? And what do the people of Crimea want? They've already spoken, but they could speak again with an internationally monitored plebiscite, perhaps by the Swiss, maybe by the Swiss, who could go and make sure that everything's according to order. This war is completely and totally unnecessary. And what it's going to end up, the Russians will go all the way through. They'll cut through. They'll destroy the Ukrainian army. And we'll have another Vietnam on our hands. Everybody will scuttle out with their tail between their legs, as they did in Afghanistan. And then the peace deal will not be equal, will be set by the Russian Federation. None of this needed to happen. Why have they cut off Russia today? We can't get Russia today. We're supposed to be a free democracy. We're not allowed to hear what Putin has to say. Oh, this terrible man, Putin. Why can't we listen to what he's got to say? Why can't we listen to his speeches? Why is the country, why is deep state, why is Washington so frightened that we might listen and say, just a minute, the guy sounds actually reasonably rational. Wouldn't this be better than war? Wars are always bad things. I'm a military man. I'm ex-military. Wars are always bad. Wars are bad. Wars hardly ever work. They don't do anybody any good. Just a lot of young men get killed, and it's very expensive, and a lot of stuff gets destroyed. We could have fixed this 2 months ago, and the word I'm getting from Washington is that Boris scuppered it. Boris Johnson scuppered it because he thinks that the Ukrainians can win. Take it from me, anybody who's watching this, the Ukrainians cannot conceivably win any more than the Americans could win in Afghanistan. It's not going to happen, and it's all going to end in tears, as wars always do.
So there are people who's, and this is an annoying thing about this war, is that the people who support Ukraine tend to tell themselves and believe that Ukraine can win, because it should win, because they support Ukraine. Then the people who are sympathetic to Russia will say that Russia can win. And I think both sides are believing what they want to believe. But it's always seemed to me, well, not always, but from early on, it seemed to me that Ukraine can't possibly win this. It just seems, and I'm certainly not a military historian or strategist, but it just seems, on a layman's opinion, common sense, that Russia is going to eventually grind the Ukrainian army to nothing. And if not by actual military action, then simply by attrition, by the weather, the winter.
This is quite true. The Russians have somewhere in the region of 500,000 men, and unbeknown, it seems, to the general public in this country, and probably Washington, in the United States, is that they're extremely well equipped. We had our chief of general staff the other day say, oh, they've got rusty rifles and no boots. This is the kind of ridiculous propaganda that we have been subject to for years and years and years and decades and centuries. This is the reason we went to war in 1914 for no good reason whatsoever. There was no reason for us to get involved in the Great War, in World War One. It was absolutely crazy, but it was driven by propaganda and emotion. We didn't get involved in the Franco-Prussian War because it was nothing to do with us. It was nothing to do with us in 1914, and it cost us 1 million war dead and 2 million British Empire maimed. War is terrible. War never works. Now, I'm a geopolitical strategist. I'm trained in these matters. I was at Sandhurst. I've done the Sandhurst Soviet Studies course, Russian Studies course. And this is sort of what I do for a living. And I'm not pro-Russian or pro-Ukraine. It's nothing to me one way or the other. What I'm doing is taking a professional view of the geopolitical strategy. Now, the problem is, if I go to the pub, with me, with all my qualifications and background, and I'm a published military historian, the man who's read this morning's Daily Mail thinks he's my equal. He argues with me.
Yes.
He couldn't point to the Ukraine on the map. And so we've got a lot of very stupid people who are going along with this, waving their blue and yellow flags, putting them up in the garden, who have no more idea than fly to the moon what this is all about. And of course, they're cut off from any counter argument. They're not allowed to listen. Nobody's allowed on TV. Nobody's allowed to come on and say, look, this is what the truth of the matter is. This is the situation. And that is not a democratic view. That is not how a democracy should work. We should be told what's going on. And so people can make their own decision when they come to a conclusion.
Well, I mean, this is an aspect of modern life, contemporary life. It seems to be something that's manifest in the last 5 or 10 years, that there is one opinion allowed on any issue that matters, any key issue. there is one opinion that's allowed on it, and that's it. And any other opinion means that you're a bad person or ignorant at best, but probably a bad person. So you have to support Ukraine. And then people get in on this. And same with COVID, every other issue. So you have to support Ukraine. And then people get in on that and sort of jump on enthusiastically the chance to be a virtuous person and have the blue and yellow flag wherever they can display it. It seems to be a very strange aspect of modern society. But it has this effect with this matter, with the Ukraine war. It has this effect that people, as you said, seem to believe that Putin is just some sort of nutcase. It doesn't, like, his actions don't make any sense. It's just bizarre. So he's obviously a maniac. And I've heard reasonable, intelligent people say that because they never hear the other side of it. They never hear the Russian side of things. The BBC is only telling them, well, the Western establishment view of it, and nothing else. And it's amazing because people do believe that they live in a democracy and, you know, that issues are discussed openly and rationally by intelligent, capable, qualified people on TV and on the radio and whatever. But that really isn't the case anymore. I don't know if it's ever actually been the case. What would you say to that?
Well, you're absolutely right in your assessment, because it doesn't matter what the subject is, the major subjects of the day. And I don't understand why I've got friends who are pretty intelligent people, but, you know, with mathematics degrees from Cambridge. I've got all sorts of friends of mine who simply can't believe that there's another side of the story to the Russian Federation-Ukraine confrontation. They just think that somehow Putin just woke up one morning and invaded the Ukraine for no reason. It's totally irrational, but of course that brings us on, does it not? It brings us on to the recent COVID nonsense. We knew from the very beginning, and my blog site went up almost at the very beginning of this, 3 years ago, as you know, and one of the hats I wore when I finished in the City of London in 1991, I think it was, I finished my last appointment in the city before I went into private consultancy, was the chief executive of a life insurance company. And I've been running pensions and life insurance funds in the city for many, many years. So I'm familiar with life insurance, pensions and actuarial statistics. And I was trying to tell people, but people didn't want to listen, that if you were basically under 75 years old and reasonably healthy, there was almost zero chance of you dying from COVID if you didn't have comorbidity. Now the statistics have come out, and they're endorsing what I said at the beginning, that most people who died of COVID without morbidity were actually over 80 years old. Now, here's the interesting thing. They changed the name of experimental spike protein therapy to a vaccine. And here we come in with 80% of the population being stupid again. They changed the name. It's not a vaccine. It's experimental spike protein therapy. But they've admitted if they called it that, nobody would have taken the jab if they knew it was experimental. And so if you were, for example, a 50-year-old healthy female or male, your chances of recovering from COVID without comorbidity was 99.9%. Why on earth would you have an experimental jab to prevent you getting something with which there was no chance of killing you? But the propaganda motored through. Doctors, NHS, nurses were all jabbing and jabbing and jabbing. And this is now coming home to roost. When you look at the actuarial statistics for people in between 21 and 39, the excess deaths now are up in the region of 25% in the Anglosphere, because it's the effect of spike protein. You are still not allowed to say this on mainstream TV. The NHS are still pushing you to get the jab, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. Why would anybody fit and healthy, knowing what we know now, go and have experimental spike protein therapy when we know the excess deaths? And if you look at the life insurance statistics in America, which are coming out, international actuarial statistics, there's something called group life. If you join a FTSE 100 company or an S&P 500 company, you get automatically four times your salary life insurance. It comes up with the rations if you are one of those employees. And of course, by definition, they're healthier. They're in between 21, 22, 23, and 39. By definition, they're healthier, otherwise they wouldn't get the job, and they're in work. Their excess deaths now are more than Joe Public on the street for the first time ever since group life's been invented, because they've all been jabbed. And it's coming home to roost with myocarditis. I have seven friends and acquaintances, neighbors, you know, seven, five of whom are undergoing very serious treatment at cardiac units locally, and two have died.
And still, the NHS
is saying, get the jab. This is scandalous, and we should have a serious inquiry into this, and I would start sending people to prison. People like Matt Hancock and Javid and all these people should be in prison. They knew this, and they still pressed it home, and they're still pressing it home. They have to go to prison.
Yeah, I agree. I think a problem here is that clearly a vast majority of the public, if I were to guess, it's something like 90 to 95% of people simply will not think outside of the box. They're just not built to do it. And so this is how you end up with, as you said, people who are educated at Cambridge, highly intelligent. And yet when it comes to violating, to going against the norms of their society, they're like a deer caught in the headlights. They simply cannot do it. And so they default to just believing whatever is the thing to believe, whatever is the consensus. And this, I never knew this was such a thing. I never knew this was such a problem until the age of COVID. I saw it with other things, fashionable ideas, climate change and all that kind of thing. But then COVID really brought it home to me that most people, to put it in a rather crass and self-aggrandizing way, most people simply can't think for themselves. And that's a much more real problem than I ever understood before. I mean, this is what I mean. It seems to fall to people like you and me who are naturally disagreeable to actually look at society rationally. That's the point I'm making.
You're quite right. There seems to be a problem with post-war generation. I think it's a post-war generation thing. There is an absence of two fundamental things in life. One is critical thinking. We are not, it seems, happy with critical thinking. We seem to like to go with the flow. At least 80% of the people will go with the flow. Critical thinking. And the second is risk assessment. Now, the funny thing is, people make a risk assessment every day. When you change your job, whether you decide to overtake that tractor and trailer, where you decide to overtake it, and you don't overtake on a blind bend or the brow of a hill, or at least most of us don't, you've made a risk assessment. It's natural. We're inbred. It's in our gene pool to make risk assessments. But it seems to me that we abandon that by an authority figure tells us to do so. And of course, what bigger authority figure is there than a GP or a nurse? Or a midwife to a pregnant woman? She is, you know, how can it be that a pregnant woman is told not to have alcohol, not to smoke, not to eat shellfish, but experimental spike protein therapy is okay? Now, you would think if you were a pregnant woman, you'd go, just a minute, if I can't do this, this, and this, if I can't have a glass of wine and a smoke, how come you're telling me to have this? And of course, it's coming home to roost, isn't it? Now we're getting babies with the problem. People are jabbing their children who are in zero danger, not 99.9, zero. They are in zero danger. What kind of parents takes their child for an experimental spike protein therapy, knowing what we know now? What is the matter with people? These people are child abusers, and I'm losing my Christian ethos and ethics here, because when I see somebody who's just fallen off their perch of 25 years old, who was otherwise perfectly fit, had the jab, I'm saying, sod you, more fool you. But yeah. I've run out of sympathy.
Yeah, I know what you
mean. And so this is the problem, and we're still doing it. And I made a pod. I did a video 18 months ago, and it's still on my website. And when Boris was Prime Minister, I said, Boris, look, you panicked, you overreacted. Okay, nobody's going to, you know, chastise you for that. You overreacted. You were probably given bad advice. Now, it's quite obvious that COVID isn't a problem. It's not killing anybody unless you're very, very old with comorbidity. So let's get back to square one. Let's unravel it all and get back to work before we damage the economy irrevocably. There were more lockdowns after I made that. We already knew this. So how is it that an old geezer like me, sitting in a little small holding in East Yorkshire, knew all this 2 years ago? Where were all the TV journalists? Where was fake Julia Hartley Brewer, who was still, up until only months ago, advocating that people had the jab? You know, oh, have the jab. Yes, I agree, have the jab. She didn't like lockdown, and she was sort of on the fringe. Controlled opposition. That's controlled opposition. All these people who pretend that they're pretty spiky people punching back at deep state and authority, they're not. They're part of the problem. She still won't apologise, and she's not alone. I'm not just having a pop at Julia Hartley Brewer. I'm talking about all these people. And Jeremy Vine, where's Jeremy Vine? And he's gone mad. What happened to Jeremy Vine? I did 35 of his shows over 10 years ago, and he was perfectly rational sort of guy. Like him or hate him, it doesn't matter. He was perfectly rational. He's totally irrational now. He's mad.
Well, a lot of them are. You know, this is the weird thing. People that you used to be able to look up to and feel quite comfortable respecting generally on matters have suddenly become very ideological. And I have no idea why this is. I think the my only explanation is that a memo must have gone around, or a new management ethos must have been inculcated in the media, in the BBC, and whatever. That basically, from now on, we are a propaganda outlet, and you're not allowed to stray from the line. You're not allowed to question the line. This is now your job. Your job is now to reinforce the official line, whatever it be, on whatever topic, because that seems to be what they're doing. So I'm guessing it must have been quite consciously decided upon that this is now the job of journalists.
It was. I shared a platform in London 6 weeks ago with a retired producer of Sky. It's on my website. His speech is on the website. It's a 10-minute speech in London. And it's there for all to see for people to get on my website. Can't remember his name, but he came out and he was quite clear about it. And he said, there was a meeting between Channel 4, Channel 5, BBC and Sky. We got together, and there was an ethos that said, we will not challenge the COVID vaccination narrative. It will not be challenged. And it wasn't challenged on any channel. And I've got some other names for you as well. If you remember Kate Silverton, for example, on BBC, and one or two other people who actually said in production meetings at the beginning, we're not doing our job. We're not doing our job. We should be getting both sides. We should be examining this situation, and we should be bringing on people like Professor Cahill in Dublin, who is a leading world figure on virology and immunology, and many others. They should be brought on, shouldn't they, to say, look, here are some dangers here. We don't know about this. They weren't allowed on. This was a conspiracy, and people are dying now. Excess deaths are off the Richter scale, not from old people, from people from 22, 23 to 40. Healthy people, hitherto healthy people. We have to call these people to account, and we have to talk about jail sentences.
I agree. I mean, this is something that it's one thing for there to be a party line on climate change or any other issue of the day, but this one has directly resulted in people's deaths. And there's just no question. I mean, at this point, it's pretty much every day, certainly every week, a celebrity dies young, like someone in their 20s or 30s, just drops dead suddenly. And this is why on Twitter, the hashtag died suddenly has become a thing. is trending all the time. I mean, the evidence is right there. It's I think undeniable. If it's not the COVID vaccine, then it must be there has to be some other reason because there has to be some reason for this phenomenon because this phenomenon is clearly real at this point. It's undeniable. As I say, I think it pretty much. I mean, every day I've got this news feed, this automatic thing with Windows that tells me, oh, someone's just died, and every day it's someone who's just dropped dead. And it never used to be like this. And people get habituated to our situation very quickly. But, you know, it really wasn't like this 2 years ago. People, you wouldn't get young people, 20, 30-somethings, just dying for no reason. I mean, if they did, it would be some drug binge or something like that. But for no reason, it's just astonishing.
Some of these young people are athletes. Many of them are athletes. It's not a question of being about Joe Soap, who might be a little bit overweight and maybe drinks a bit too much. We're talking about athletes. Some, of course, representative. In your case, Scottish lady rugby international. This is quite extraordinary. But being of my background that I am, with an actuarial professional background, not an actuary, but from running actuarial teams and looking at life insurance statistics and pension statistics as a professional, one thing I can tell you is you can't hide the numbers forever. You can't hide numbers forever. You can hide lots of stuff, but not numbers. Because there will come a stage, and don't forget, we're only two or three years in. We're only talking about the immediate consequences of this 2 or 3 years in. We don't know where we are in 5 years' time. We don't know where we are in 10 years' time. We already know that in America, the life expectancy has stalled. It's gone up every year for decades and decades and decades, and it's stalled. It's flatlining now. So we know that there's a mortality situation here, and you can't hide those numbers forever. And I forecast this 18 months ago. It's all on my website. In fact, my website on COVID is the biggest in Europe now. It's got over 1 million words. And I've been pointing this out for 2 years. Every statistic, and it's not mine, it's I edit all the people from all over the world who are experts with their graphics and their data and their statistics. And that's what I do. I assess all this because that's what I do for a living. I'm a researcher. I'm a research man. You know, I crunch the numbers. So it's all there. So we know this is happening, and I made this forecast a year ago. I said there will come a time, and this group life thing is that I talked about is coming through, that now if you want to buy life insurance from a life insurance company, one of the questions will be, are you a smoker? And if you are a smoker, you will be rated probably about 4 years. That used to be the norm. It might have gone up a bit. But generally speaking, you were rated if you were a smoker. What I can assure you, because I was in the game, I would suggest in 18 months' time, if you want to buy life insurance at 22 or 25 or 31 or 35 or 40 years old, one of the questions will be, have you had the COVID jab? And if you have, they will rate you 5 years because you have endangered your own life. The reason I have no friends is because I'm always right.
Yeah, I know the feeling. One question that does arise from all this is the matter of is the poison in the dose, the quantity. I saw a graph today that showed the stillbirths that went up massively in 2021 last year, but they'd gone down again this year. So there was a massive jump. I think it was in America, for the first year that people were taking the vaccines, but then it went down sharply. Not anywhere close to the norm, to the historical norm, but still went down sharply from the year before. And so I wonder if there's anything you could say about this. Basically, for want of a better phrasing, is the vaccine going to wear off, or is it now a permanent change to people's physiology? And of course, as an extension of that, does it matter how many doses of the vaccine people got, or is just one dose enough? Is there any data on that?
There is data, and the data so far, because sometimes, you know, in these statistics, actuarial statistics and life expectancy, it takes a very long time for them to show. It doesn't show in a year or 2 years or 3 years. The equivalent of this was dairy products in the 1980s. Everybody thought dairy products were bad for you, harmful. Butter and cheese and milk. And all. This was bad for you in the 80s, and everybody had to eat margarine and for all that kind of shit. Now, the only way we could do this, and I was very much on this at the time, because I wasn't chief executive of Life Insurance Company there, but I was climbing the tree. And we could only tell that this was not true, that there was nothing wrong with dairy products. They didn't give you a decrease your life expectancy, but the only statistics available were from New Zealand. And they had statistics over a generation. You can't take statistics on 3, 4, 5, or 6, or even 10 years. It doesn't work. You have to have a generation to see where you are going. And those statistics prove beyond any shadow of doubt that dairy products didn't have any effect on your life expectancy whatsoever. The same I was around then, too, was AIDS, which they had a huge advertising campaign that we were all in danger. We were all in danger of getting AIDS, regardless of who we were, what our lifestyle was, which simply isn't and wasn't true. It isn't true. I won't go into gory details, but I mean, that just isn't true. And we tried to terrorize everybody instead of looking at the focus group of people who were actually getting it. In the same way of deaths from COVID were over 80s. What we should have done was isolate as far as reasonably possible, not against their own family, but people who were at risk, which are the over 80s. They're the kind of people that should be. You don't isolate the entire healthy population. What kind of stupidity and craziness was that? And that you could stop a respiratory virus with a mask. Does anybody not know the size of a virus and the size of the mesh in a mask? Anybody here today watching this channel who's wearing a mask, you're an idiot. You're an idiot.
Yes.
You can't stop respiratory viruses. And then to think if you keep six feet away, you're not going to get it, or you're saving yourself. Have you not walked through the fields in the springtime and seen a farmer maybe a mile away spraying his fields, spraying the crops, and you can smell it a mile away if the wind is in that direction? Have you looked back? Our grandchildren will look back on this. Our great-grandchildren will look back. Well, what were they thinking? What were they snorting that they believed all this shit?
Indeed, and also the screens up to guard, so that to cut off airflow between tables at restaurants and things like that. I mean, I think it is going to look surreal. It did at the time. The most strange thing was that most people went along with it. Again, it's easy to forget this. It's 2 years now, but the world really did seem insane in 2020 and the first half of 2021 as well. And I don't know what to say about that. It just takes me back to the thing about consensus, and people will go along with whatever. It's bizarre, really. So basically, and I remember what you were saying about dairy products in the 80s, because another aspect of that was that mothers were advised not to breastfeed. They were advised to use formula milk instead of breastfeeding, which just seems incredible now. That these things come and go, these fads come and go. But I suppose a rational question to ask about all of this is, why did it happen? Because my own theory, I'll be just upfront about this, my own theory is they were trying to scaremonger people so that they would get the vaccine. And so they did various things. But one of the things I think was lockdown itself, because that probably reduced people's vitamin D, made them more susceptible to things, their immune systems suppressed, so that they would get more ill, and so that people, as many people as possible, would get the vaccine. That's my own theory about this. I mean, do you think that, well, what do you think actually happened in 2020? Do you think it was just incompetence, craziness, or do you think it was more sinister than that?
It's extremely difficult to understand. When I went into politics, I was only in politics for 10 years, and that was for a specific thing, not a professional politician. I went in because I was a Brexiteer. I'm a businessman. I'm a fund manager. I'm an economist by profession and one-time soldier many years back. But I thought perhaps when I got into politics and I had met and had lunch with quite senior political figures, although I was a very junior political figure, I did meet quite a lot of senior people. And I thought when that happened, that something would be open to me. I would see behind the Green Baize door the reason that they did these things. The reason that they did these things, which to the man on the Clapham Omni bus seems absolutely extraordinarily stupid. They have a plan. They have a reason. And when I got behind the Green Baize door, it was quite apparent that they didn't. They are a group of the most stupid people I've ever met. Professional politicians are unbelievably stupid. And I worked for Ray Snooty Investment Bank, the Warburg Empire, in the 80s. And everybody there was really sharp as a razor. They came from the Sorbonne, Heidelberg, Yale, Harvard, Oxford. They came from, these people were the corps d'élite, and very highly paid people they were too. Now, the people I met in politics were asinine. They don't understand anything. They're stupid people. And if you look, they haven't had the benefit of a traditional education, any of them. Yes, some of them have been to Oxford. Let's take David Cameron. He got a first in PPE at Oxford, became prime minister. And when he was in America, which was hushed up a bit here, when he was in America, he was interviewed in America, and somebody wanted to talk to him about Magna Carta and the principles of law, Anglo-Saxon law, and so on and so forth. He couldn't string a sentence together. He simply didn't know. He didn't know anything. He didn't know when America came into the war. He didn't know what in Normandy, what the ratio of British Empire to American troops were, which is significantly more at that stage of the war than the Americans. And said, we were the junior partner. David Cameron is a stunningly stupid man because he hasn't had the benefit of a traditional education. And that doesn't mean something in a lamadier. I got a first at Oxford. Nowadays, if you meet somebody who got a first at Oxford, he's got a neon light on his forehead saying, I'm a moron. They're morons. which is why we have this climate hoax, which is a hoax. And when I was on the Environment Committee in the European Union, European Parliament, I was on for 3 years, and I had quite a significant staff of researchers, as everybody does. There's thousands of researchers for all the political parties and countries in there. And I was trying to find any evidence that climatic carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was going to create global warming. We were going to boil to death. So I said, where is it? So I actually said, I'll give a prize to everybody, a case of champagne, good champagne, for anybody who can show me the graphics that proves that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere precedes global warming. So nobody could provide it because there is none. I also have one of the biggest website pages in England on this subject, with statistics showing that there has been no significant increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Why can nobody explain to me the Minoan warm period, the Roman warm period, the medieval warm period, the mini ice age? What has it got to do? And even that film of Al Gore, you know, the Al Gore film, The Inconvenient Truth, if you freeze phrase it halfway through, you'll see behind his head the statistics that show that atmospheric carbon dioxide comes after global warming. And if you take it back 15,000 years to the Pleistocene areas and beyond, you'll find that we are actually at an all-time low in atmospheric carbon dioxide, not an all-time high. And if you look at the temperatures over that period of time, you'll see that we are in a cool period now, not a warm period. All this, you can find on my website, which I've researched with other people who are experts in the field. So do you get Professor Ian Plimer, the world's leading climate authority on TV? Do you get Professor Bjørn Longberg? Do you get all these other people coming on TV to give a balanced view? No, you get the wee Swedish doom goblin. You get Emma Thompson.
Yes.
You get Harrison Ford. You get that crass idiot who is now King Charles III. When he was Prince of the World, don't know anything. The guy's a buffoon.
Of course. He's just he knows what his advisors told him.
We're not getting. Where's the debate? Where's the debate? Is the climate warming? And even if it was warming marginally, because there is climate change, nobody denies climate change. I'm not denying that. Climate has been changing since the year dot. The question is, why is it changing? Why is it changing? Is it on the margin? And if you look at history, mild global warming has been very good for the planet. The crops go up. It's a better period. It's when the world goes through a cooling period that you find that crops fail and things get difficult. Why aren't we discussing this? Why isn't everybody talking about this? Because at the moment, we are destroying our ethos, our culture, our way of life. They're seizing farms in Holland. Thousands of farms. This is based on fake science. But we're and this business that the majority of scientists say there's that's not true. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of scientists who say there is no climate emergency. The ones that say there's a climate emergency are funded by people whose interest it is to say there's a climate emergency. There is no debate.
Yes.
Where's the debate?
Exactly. I remember this stopping in like the mid-2000s on TV. It just stopped. You just did not get the debates anymore about climate change. And then it went away when the global financial crisis happened. But then a couple of years later, it started returning again. It was like they were pushing this notion of climate change. Why is a very good question. I really don't know. I'm guessing it's just vested interests. Same with COVID. They have vested interests in people believing this stuff. That's speculation, of course. I was looking for this thing that I saw the other day when you mentioned Greta Thunberg. It reminded me. Here is a graphic, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I'll just put it up on screen. Here it is. So this is apparently the temperature range throughout the Earth's history, the last 5 million years. And then this bit that she used for her book cover is a tiny, tiny sliver of world history. Now, I don't know whether that's accurate or not. My point is that this is the kind of thing that I do know for a fact they've done in the past. I've seen it. Where they will cherry pick data because in order to produce the picture that they want. Did you see that, Godfrey, the graphic that I just put up?
Yes, I did. But of course, as an ex-merchant banker, I can assure you can make statistics show anything you want. I can. I was a past master at it.
Exactly.
It's the name of the game. Reversion to the mean, the Simpsons paradox. It's full of stuff that politicians don't understand. I could prove to the average politician that the moon is made of green cheese quite easily by the careful use of statistics. But what you can't change is long-term statistics, which I show on my website, the long-term. And when I say long-term historically, you have to look in terms of 1,000 years. You can't talk in terms of decades or whether it might be a bit warmer this year than it was last. You can't do that. But that's why, and I say, they're not graphics that I produce. They're graphics produced by climate scientists who are claiming that there is no climate emergency. But of course, look who's involved in this. BlackRock, Vanguard, as well as Vanguard have just come out of the game, incidentally. The people who really control, as Rothschild said, is people who control the money. It doesn't matter who's in number 10 Downing Street or the Chancellor of the Exchequer. That's all meaningless. Who controls the international money? Who are the oligarchs? Who's the biggest landowner in America? Bill Gates. Who's the biggest pharmaceutical shareholder in the world? Bill Gates. So he's going to come on and say, take the jab. The jab's good for you. And you might need a series of jabs. And then you need a booster. Oh, there's another pandemic coming next year. And don't worry, we'll work on a vaccine. Well, you would, wouldn't you? That's what you'd say. If I was selling ice cream, I'd say, well, what you really need in a diet, a diet simply isn't a good diet. It's not a balanced diet unless you have ice cream every day. Of course I'd say that, wouldn't I? Because yeah. I'm in the business of selling ice cream.
Yeah, and I remember seeing a clip, it was shared around, of Bill Gates saying that he'd made an astonishing profit on his investment into vaccines. I think he said it was 20 to 1. For every dollar he'd put in, he got $20 back. So absolutely astonishing sums that he must have made out of the vaccine thing, which again, in turn, would seem to explain why they wanted everyone to get the vaccine. Or at least that's one reason. I think the profit is one reason. He's also
profit's one reason, money is a strong driver, but he's a Malthusian. He believes there are too many people on the planet. That is his deep belief, and he's on record. It's not a conspiracy theorist. He's perfectly open about that, and he's not alone, saying there are too many people. Population is growing too fast. Well, what better than to give 90% of the population a dodgy injection which shortens their lives? He's a Malthusian. He would say that. Of course, that's what he believes. And so would you take a jab? It goes back to risk assessment. Would you take a jab for a man who believes there are too many people on the planet? And isn't it you wouldn't, would you? I wouldn't. Isn't it interesting that where they couldn't afford the jabs, the life expectancy is increasing? So Africa, where they couldn't afford all these jabs, didn't have them, their so-called COVID deaths were sort of miles lower than the Western economies and the Anglosphere. This is quite extraordinary. But when you have mainstream media, which is bought and sold lock, stock and barrel by these oligarchs, there is almost no newspaper that isn't receiving money from Bill Gates. The BBC has got money from Bill Gates. The Daily Telegraph gets money from Bill Gates. The Daily Telegraph. Oh, the holy Daily Telegraph. You know, no, they're all on the take. George Monbiot, the pages, the Guardian, and all these, and the climate pages, and all the rest of it in the so-called quality newspapers are funded by Bill Gates, which is why you won't have mainstream media actually say, just a minute, this is fake science. Nobody's allowed to say it's fake science. So your man on the Clapham omnibus, your man in the pub, gets his information from the BBC or the tabloid newspapers, which is deliberately designed to give him misinformation. And if you try and put them right on social media, you're taken off for misinformation. You couldn't invent all this kind of stuff.
Absolutely not. It's dystopian.
It's just crazy. We live in a crazy world.
Yeah, it's literally dystopian. On the matter of George Monbiot, a few months ago, he was there was a thing, a furore sort of, where he was saying that we need to basically stop eating meat. We need to just cut it out of our diets completely. And he was like, he was being absolutist about it. I mean, he wasn't saying, well, we should try to reduce it. It was, we should eliminate it from our diets. He's, of course, the famous Guardian journalist, the climate change guy. That brings me, and of course, I'm pretty sure that Bill Gates is involved in synthetic meat as well. I'm not sure about that, but if he's not, then somebody else certainly will be. But that brings me on to the one other thing I'd like to ask you about, which you alluded to earlier, which is the Dutch government wanting to shut down its farming sector by 30%. That just seems absolutely incredible to me. That's something that you wouldn't make up, because it's so extreme that people just wouldn't believe it, that a country, a government, would reduce its own farming sector by 30%, and not even over a large time frame, very quickly. And supposedly this is about nitrogen in the atmosphere. What do you have to say about that? I mean, that seems to me one of the biggest things that's happened this year.
Well, it's extraordinary. The Dutch voted in Mark Rutte for the second time, knowing him to be a madman. They voted in Trudeau a second time, knowing him to be a madman. In Australia, in Victoria, where we saw thug policeman beating up women under the orders of Dan Andrews. He's been re-elected in Victoria, in Australia. You have to ask yourself, what is it with people that vote these people in? The Dutch voted them in. They didn't just come off planet Mars. They voted for Mark Rutte, who's destroying, significantly, deliberately destroying the Netherlands. They voted for him. So you have to get a Dutchman on your show and say, what cretinous people are the Dutch that they voted this guy in again? Get an Aussie in from Victoria and say, Dan Andrews has got back in. Are you crazy? And I've gone mad in Australia. New Zealand, they've got that woman who looks like one of my horses. What's her name? Jackie Ardern.
Jacinda Ardern, yeah.
Who I gather stands 14 hands. But leaving that aside, she's a disgusting woman. Whatever made the Kiwis vote her in? I mean, that's like putting grandma in at 6'5" on their bloody All Blacks side, isn't it? What kind of selection procedure is this?
Indeed. Well, I do have a Dutchman on coming on later to discuss. I can't remember what day, but he will be discussing that whole matter. I do have an Australian coming on, hopefully, who'll talk about Dan Andrews. There is a Kiwi coming on, but he's not going to be talking about that. But yeah, I'm trying to get a rounded view of things. But I would ask your opinion about this. Why is the Dutch government desirous of something which seems just obviously crazy to reduce your own farming sector, especially given the situation with Russia and Ukraine, with the wheat and grain, all of that? This seems the worst time to be reducing your own farming sector. But I believe the British government are doing the same thing, actually. They've been paying farmers to just stop farming. I don't know what to think about this, because the implication is obvious, that you know they're just basically destroying our societies.
When we successfully got the referendum, won the referendum for Brexit, an old stager, Remainer, came up to me and he made some interesting comments, which I didn't really think of too much at the time. This was back in 2016. He said, you've won all this on take back control. take back control. He said, but you won't take back control. He said, you're under the illusion that Brussels was governing Britain, but all the laws came from another tier of management. He said it's the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Health Organization. He says you haven't taken back control. You've just taken out of tier of management. They will now tell you directly what to do. So, again, as Rothschild said, control the money. Of course, it still goes the same for food. Control the food. If you destroy the food chain, people will then have to get somehow their ration of food, like they did in the 1939-45 war. They'll have to get their ration. They'll be rationed. So you won't be allowed to eat meat, or you'll only be allowed a few ounces of meat a week. You'll only be allowed so much travel because carbon dioxide is killing the planet and all this kind of thing. So it'll be digital currency. Cash will have disappeared. So your viewers today who want to take a second holiday to Spain will be told that they can't go, they've had their ration of holiday. When they go for their Sunday joint, they say, no, sorry, you're allowed one piece of meat a month. You can't have a Sunday joint. But of course, this is very difficult to explain to people, because people are asleep. And yes, it's sometimes fault. It's not necessarily their fault. They're living lives of quiet desperation,
yeah,
trying to make ends meet. Heavily taxed, heavily regulated, unless, of course, you're in the public sector. If you were in the public sector, Augusta Voyager, your index-linked pension is marvelous. Get a job in the public sector. But if you're in the wealth-creating sector, you're toast. And if you're the ordinary dude, you're the cab driver, the hairdresser, the butcher, the baker. If you're one of these people, you're going to the wall. You're being crushed ever more slowly by the system who want rid of you, small businessmen. This is all Brexit. The European Union was about big business. it's fascist, and I don't use the term fascist in a pejorative sense here, which a lot of people do, the National Union of Students, you know, gobbing off. No, it's a system of government fascism, which is a collusion between politicians, big business, and the banks. That is fascism. And it's a very well-respected and well-liked system, which originated in Italy, of course, under Mussolini, and carried on through Spain under Franco. Not National Socialism that Hitler had. That's a different game altogether, although it had its similarities. This is what the big people want. They want to control the little people, because and it goes right up. It goes up to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's a WEF sponsor. You've got the King Charles III, who's sponsored. This isn't a conspiracy theory. If you go, and I've got a page on the WEF, you'll find pictures of all these people on a website in Davos with the WEF. They are. That's where they are. It isn't a conspiracy. It's not mad Godfrey Bloom. This is there. For goodness sake, wake up. Will people wake up? The trouble is, people watching your show have already woken up, or they wouldn't be watching this show. You haven't got people watching this show going, gosh, I didn't know that. That's amazing. You won't have them. The people already know.
Yes, it's an unfortunate thing, and this is why they deplatform you. You know, the last time we spoke, I was still on YouTube. I've since been banned from YouTube, and the annoying thing is that means I cannot reach the general public anymore. And not that they were ever, listening in droves, but there was always the ability for them to happen upon my channel, happen upon my live stream. When you're on the alt tech websites like Odyssey and BitChute, that doesn't happen anymore. And it's frustrating because, well, for a multitude of reasons, but one of them is you can't reach the general public. But the thing is, what I was going to ask you about this was, I can imagine if an average mainstream person heard the conversation that we are having, they would think these two sound paranoid, like tinfoil hat wearing nutters, believing in quite long-winded conspiracy theories. They've invented this whole thing about people wanting to control the public, control them. But to me, it's really just self-evident. I mean, it's like the situation is so extreme that people don't believe it, even though it's real. You know what I mean? It feels like this is something that you wouldn't make up because it's so over the top.
Well, my response is, and you're quite right, my website has been pretty active and pretty broad now for 6 years. I haven't taken anything off it. So if you think I'm a swivel-eyed lunatic, have a look at what I was saying 6 years ago, and it's all come true. Everything I have said has come true. My speeches on the collapse of banks and the crisis that we're going to have in fiat currency I made in 2012, which actually got those speeches hit overall 60 million views. 60 million views. So there is a hunger for this information. And I think we are going into a phase now where people are going to wake up because we're going into a freezing winter and people can't afford to heat their homes. Prices going up, inflation's happening as I said it would, which is degrading money. If you print money with a machine, quantitative easing they call it, but it's counterfeiting, you would degrade the money supply and it puts the prices up, and it's come out of assets now into Main Street, Wall Street to Main Street, and people are finding this. I think by the time we finish this winter, people are going to say, just a minute, we've been legged over. We've had our arse felt. What's going on? And then I think you'll find people will say, just a minute, it was freezing. 30 years we put up with this this business about climate, global warming. 30 years. Some people who actually say they're freezing at home and grandma's died from hypothermia, they're going to say, when's it going to happen? When's this bullshit going to happen? I think that day's coming soon.
Yeah, I think you might be right. It seems that this winter is going to be, it already feels pretty harsh. It already feels a fairly severe winter. I would imagine it's going to be, that's going to continue. And of course, that's the worst possible time for us in Western Europe because of the energy shortages, the gas bills and so on, because of the Russia sanctions, because of the Ukraine war. So, and of course, one thing that we haven't even mentioned is Nord Stream. Do you have anything to say about that, the Nord Stream pipeline?
Well, two points that you make. Firstly, is that you'll see the massive increase in gas and oil over a period of time and heating. That's been going on since well before the Ukraine situation. That's well before this last February, well before. The Ukraine situation has added to it, but it was already happening. They're saying, oh, it's Putin. No, it was already happening because of green policies. We've been blowing up our coal-fired central heating. Wind turbines don't work, which everybody knows, so we just think we need more of them. They're all made in China, or most of them made in China. They're put together by using coal fire that actually manufactured them, and then they're sent here by China. We've got thousands of acres being turned over in England to solar panels. We've got them in my own parish here, solar panels in Yorkshire. I mean, who's shitting who here? Sun power in Yorkshire. I mean, I love Yorkshire. I don't, and your lot are even worse.
Yes, of course.
I mean, not going to work, is it? It's completely crazy. So now, if we get back to peace, when the Russians trundle over and we get round a table, as we're going to have to do, we'll get round a table and we'll have to come up with a peace solution, because that's got to happen, and it won't be on the terms that NATO wanted. It's a bit like picking a fight, and I can tell you I've done that in my time, but when I was a young man, picked a fight and then rather wish I hadn't, because I didn't know the guy in the corner there was his brother. So suddenly you get a bit of a shooing because there's two of the buggers. And that was in Scotland, incidentally, but I'll leave that one aside. We're going to find ourselves in a situation around the table. We're going to have to eat a large slice of humble pie. And the Russians will be saying, we want to get back to normal. We'd like to sell you gas, but you blew up the pipe. And I can sell it to China. I can sell it to Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. I don't need you as a market. We need Russian fertilizer. We need Russian gas. We need Russian oil. We need all these things in order to live. The Russians can do without their Mercedes and BMW. They'll buy Lexus from Japan, or they'll buy cars from somewhere. They don't really need the stuff we sell them. The stuff we sell them are nice to have. The stuff they sell us, we must have. And they've blown up the gas pipe. And I've got a feeling that that's not been forgotten. And some nasty stuff could happen if they start rounding up, British mercenaries and stuff in the Ukraine, which are already out there. The stats of people like that already out there. And they're mercenaries, I'm afraid. We're not at war with Ukraine. It's not gone through Parliament. We're not at war with the Russian Federation. And they will raft them all up and they'll say, right, now we've got 2,000 Brits here. This is how it's going to be if you want them back. Or they'll go to the gulag. Because we've started something we can't conceivably finish. And no good's going to come of it. But, of course, we've blown up our own. We blew up at Egborough and Ferry Bridge. We blew them up. They're just down the road from me. Drax is here. I can see Drax from the window. This is the problem that we have. We can't go back to normal because the Americans have made sure that we can't go back to normal. The Americans have screwed Germany. It's Germany that's screwed. And I've got a feeling when the end of this winter and the unemployment starts to come in German manufacturing industries, automobiles and chemicals, because they don't have any energy, I think the Germans are going to start saying, and I think they're already saying it, they're going to say, America isn't our friend. The Americans aren't our friends. We got to live with Russia. We have to have peace with Russia. We have to trade with Russia. They're on our doorstep. Russia isn't a strategic threat to Germany or us. They were allies in the last two world wars. They're not a strategic threat. Who is the problem on the planet? And I hate to say this because I love America. I've loads of American friends, many of whom agree with me. Who is the biggest problem on the planet today? It's the Americans. They have 800 overseas bases, 200,000 overseas personnel, and every time they invade a country for a regime change, they bugger it up. They've buggered up just about everything since 1945. And until we can get rid of the neocons in Washington with their $1 trillion a year budget, an unaudited budget, the CIA is an unaudited budget. I want to know who's in the pocket of the CIA. Who are the CIA paying? Let's take Andrew Neil on this. Andrew Neil, when it was the Syrian campaign, you know, when the Americans were destabilizing Syria, it was quite interesting because there was a lot of false flag attacks, which have now come out, has been admitted to be false flag. Andrew Neil would sit there at the BBC and read out a CIA press release before anything could have been checked out at all. It was emailed to him and he read it out. And it begs the question, with the Andrew Neils of this world, what was in it for them to toe the CIA line when the CIA have a budget, which is a secret budget? Swiss bank accounts, this is what we'd like you to say. Why was the last thing that Boris Johnson said before he was kicked out of office, stay close to the Americans and support the Ukraine? Why would he, with all the pressures that he's had on everything, of being booted out of number 10 Downing Street after only 18 months, with a massive majority that he went in with, why would he kowtow to the Americans and make his last speech pro-American, pro-CIA, pro-neocon? How much was he paid for that? He had to have been paid for that. Come on. I'm a businessman. I've been around the block. I'm 73 years old. He was paid to say that. Hey, Boris, if you're watching, sue me, baby. Sue me. Tell it's not so. Say it's not so, you arsehole.
Yeah. Well, the treachery just seems to be everywhere. I mean, I'm dreading. Well, we could talk about Liz Truss. That was a farcical thing there. Now we've got Rishi Sunak. But I'm dreading the Labour Party. Keir Starmer. I think this is going to be absolutely disastrous. Do you have any comments on that, the current political situation?
Well, they all piss in the same pot. What is the difference between Keir Starmer, Boris, Lisa? They all work for the same guy. They all work for the same guy. We nothing goes through Parliament. We don't have a vote on anything. Nothing important is decided by the people we elect. They're all Muppets. We do, and Macron does, and Rutter does, and the Australians do, and the Kiwis do. They do exactly what they're told to do by the WEF, the UN, the WHO. We've already signed up to the WHO. That's not going through Parliament. The next pandemic, an ID, and all that kind of thing, has already been signed up. It's done. Our Parliament have got nothing to do with it. So it doesn't matter whether it's Starmer. People say to me, oh, well, we had to vote for Boris. Otherwise, we'd have got, what's his name, the previous dude? Can't remember his name now.
David Cameron.
The Labour guy.
Oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn.
They say, oh, well, we had to vote for Boris because we'd got Corbyn. Somebody tell me how the country could be deeper in the shit with him than it is today. We're bankrupt. We have a $3 trillion debt and growing. We can't afford to heat our houses. We have inflation at 11% and rising. Somebody tell me how it could have been any worse with the Labour Party, because I'd be interested to know.
Yeah, indeed. I actually didn't mind Jeremy Corbyn as much as a lot of people seem to. I don't know. It's a pick your poison, really, isn't it? I mean, the Tory party is dreadful. The Labour Party is dreadful. But as you said, it doesn't really matter because they're not actually in charge. And this gets back to something else you said, that politicians and the people in the world of politics aren't very bright. And you can see this and you can increasingly sense it in just the quality of discourse, the quality of decision making, the general lack of vision, the sort of gormlessness. And so it makes sense that they're not actually in charge. These are just placemen, regional managers, managing the region of Britain. But ultimately, yeah, the people in charge are at an altogether different level in the global apparatus.
We've got I mean, wasn't it particularly crass thing that Sunak said the other day? I can't stop the immigration crisis overnight. We send out the Border Patrol vessels, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution vessels, to pick these people up within sight of the French coast. We bring them in, we put them in four-star hotels, we give them pocket money, and now we've decided to fast-track their applications for British citizenship. Now, I would say to him, Rishi, baby, if you're listening, listen to this, put me in charge. I will stop it by the weekend. By the weekend, I'll mobilise the Royal Navy. I will tow them back to the French coast as soon as they set foot off. I'll destroy their boats, and I'll deploy the SAS on the French beaches to destroy their boats before they set off. I will round up everybody in a hotel that came here illegally, and I will ship them back home, and I don't give a shit about the ECHR or anything else. I don't care. Home they go. Home they go. And now I could stop that by the weekend. What does he mean he can't do it overnight? What kind of bullshit is that? Of course he could do it. Can you imagine? Can you imagine in 1940, as we looked across the channel to the Germans gathering their forces, that the only way to deal with it was to put the invading Germans into four-star hotels and process their papers and give them a bit of pocket money to be going on with?
Clearly,
I mean,
yeah.
We had a Dover patrol under under Bacon, Admiral Bacon, the Dover patrol, and we covered that piece of water. And before that, in the 1914-18, we had another Dover patrol, and we kept the enemy off our shores. We kept them off our shores because we had destroyers, we had submarines, we had corvettes, we had air power. Somebody telling me we can't stop these little men in dinghies coming ashore. Who do they think we are? Who do they think we are? How stupid does Sunak think we are? And here's another thing I'd like to say. I am uncomfortable at the amount of people who run the country, and this isn't racist, I don't care if a man's colour of his skin doesn't bother me, but if your family's been here for 5 minutes, like Javid and Sunak and all the rest of them that are in senior office, they're first generation immigrants. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I married into a Polish family. But it makes you wonder how deep the roots they have for the idea of the British ethos, the principles of English law and the Christian way of life. And I'm not talking about God bothering. I'm talking about the fundamental Christian way of life that most good families here and respect for the families have. They weren't brought up with that ethos. They came from abroad. And they're the ones with the levers of power. These people are doing it. They may not know they're doing it. They may not be doing it deliberately. But how deep is their love of our country when they've been here 5 minutes?
Yeah. Well, there's an awful lot that could be said about that. But I think just on an superficial level, only just looking at it as a layman, they are not as attached to the country as, for example, you and I are. They cannot possibly be. I mean, it would be incredible if they somehow had the depth of attachment to this land that you and I have. That's not even a judgment of them as people or whatever. It's just a fact. I mean, in the same way that I would never have the depth of attachment to India that an Indian would have. Of course not. How could I? It's clearly absurd. So, I agree with you. I certainly agree with you. But I do think you might get some heat for saying that.
But I think it needs saying. And it's not, as I said before, it's not a question of the colour of the skin. It has nothing to do with it. You've got to bear in mind that in Yorkshire, we don't think like Londoners. Scotsmen don't think like Londoners or Yorkshiremen. People living in Pennsylvania don't think like people living in California. It isn't a question of colour. I'm not mentioning colours. It's a question of if you come from another country or if your parents come from another country, you cannot have the depth of commitment to the country that somebody who has been here for generations. My father was a fighter pilot in the war. My grandfather was in the Royal Horse Artillery on the Messines Ridge. And it goes on and on and on. That is in my gene pool. These people don't have it in their gene pool. It's not because they're brown or black or green or yellow. It's got nothing to do with it at all. They just don't think like we think, and consequently, that comes out in their it comes out in the way they view some of these matters of personal freedom, which is we would regard as our birthright. Freedom, principles of English law, the 1688 Bill of Rights, the Toleration Act, all these things. And Americans feel the same about their constitution, or used to. They've abandoned their constitution. This has got nothing. This is a trouble, you see. People say, if I say this on mainstream TV, they will shout racist. It's got nothing to do with racism. It's a question of ethos and commitment to your country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would also say it's a spiritual thing. It's just a reality of the creature that we are. I mean, it's very difficult. It would be very difficult for me to think like a Chinese guy, right? Or a Japanese guy, or an Indian guy, because that's it, the culture, the history, the heritage, everything plays into it. So I think a lot of people feel the same way that you feel about this. It's just everyone's terrified to say it. Because, I mean, it's clearly been made something that's it means you're a bad person if you say this stuff. But of course it doesn't. It's just completely natural, really.
I met Sunak because he's an MP just up the road at Richmond. And he struck me as being a perfectly nice, amiable sort of chap. Got nothing against him perfectly or anybody else I've mentioned. But you have to have this question mark over commitment. And it was the same way if I was suddenly made president of the United States, they would suddenly say, just a minute, yeah, he's a nice guy, he's an articulate guy, he's got some good ideas, but is he really committed to America? He's not American.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've often thought about that kind of thing. You know, could I be responsible for another country? And not really. I mean, even America, because it's not my country.
No, and they don't think like us either, I can tell you, as you well know. As Churchill said, it's a country, two countries divided by a common language. The Americans do not think like we think. I love them and I love going to America, but they don't think like we think.
Mm, yeah, I agree. And yet we're obviously very similar countries. And yet even still, you know, there is a distance there. Well, that's great. I mean, this has been a very animated conversation, so I'd like to thank you. There are a few questions from the audience, so I'll ask those now. Hold on a second. Right. Okay, this one's from Scott. Hello, Godfrey. We missed you last year. When did you get interested in Austrian economics, and what are your favorite books in that tradition, Austrian economics?
I sort of morphed into it. It came gradually as I was a fund manager in the city. And I gradually thought that doesn't work. That's not right. That's crazy. A particularly Keynesian school economics, which, of course, has been the disaster that's got us into the hole we're in. And so I came across Austrian school economics. And I think probably if you're a beginner, I would go, or new to it, but not new to economics particularly, but if you were new to the Austrian theory and the Austrian school, I would say probably, obviously, the Bible is Mises' Human Action, which I have to mention. You have to have that on your shelf. And the other one is anything by Murray Rothbard, Rothbardian work. Those two, if you digest those two, you're 90% of the route there. And if you join the Mises Institute, you can get, you know, the stuff that they push out all the time is always worth reading, and you'll morph into it. You'll sort of morph into it. And you won't agree with everything, because that's not possible. I'm the only true libertarian who's a member of the Lord's Day Observance Society. Work that one out.
Okay. Okay, Hinchfoot. Let me see. Oh, yeah, somebody actually asked, do you have any insights into military or naval strategies for combating small boat channel migrants? This is assuming the law can be sorted. But, of course, you did give us your perspective on that earlier. So that
I will just give you one little idea of that. I would charter I would charter small boats of the size of small tugs, light tugs maybe, or one of the last world were corvettes. And I would man them heavily with Royal Marines and just simply tow them back and destroy them on the beaches. You see, you wouldn't have to do this for very long. As soon as you started towing them back and destroying the boats on the beaches, the whole thing would close down. And if you kick them out of the four-star hotels and send them back, it would close down. I mean, to be honest, if you've just been come out of Somaliland or some ghastly place which has been wrecked by the American bombs or wherever it happens to be, and somebody's saying, look, if you cross in a small boat, nobody's going to stop you. In fact, they'll pick you up. You've only been at sea for a couple of hundred yards. They'll pick you up and they'll put you in a nice four-star hotel. You'll get a hot meal. I'd have some of that, wouldn't you, if you just come out of Somalia? That's what we've got to stop, poor buggers, but we've got to stop them. Because what are going to happen? They're all young men, single young men, hanging around on the street corner. Sooner or later, you'll find the great swathes of this country where women can't go out after dark. It's already happening in Hull, incidentally, where some of the big hotels are being taken over. Women don't go out after dark. And then you're going to get vigilantism. Then you get some more seriousness, get worse and worse and worse, because it's been swept under the carpet. It's been swept under the carpet. If we don't face it now, it's going to get worse and worse. And there'll be places that there are in second-generation Algerians, for example, in France, where they have lost their country, and they'll never get it back, as far as I can see, without a major military intervention.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, actually, we've just seen recently with the football that the Moroccans have gone mad, both in France and actually in England as well. And I didn't even know there were many Moroccans in London, but I think they were rioting. I think it was last night or the night before. This gives the lie to the whole idea, you know, that they come here, but they still retain a most attachment to their ancestral country. So,
which is where they should be. Toodaloo, yes. I say to them.
I agree. Here's an interesting one from Soaker City. How much power do you think globalist institutions such as the World Economic Forum and the UN, etc., have inside Russia? How much power do you think they have inside Russia?
That's a good question. I don't know. I rather think that Putin was going along with the World Economic Forum because it was better being inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in. That's where I think it was coming from. But I think that the long and short of it is that Putin is his own man. He's his own man. And my experience, such as it is, of Russians, is that they are deeply patriotic. And I don't think they're easily influenced by anybody, especially when they're put under pressure by outside. Very patriotic nation. And also, not a secular nation. They are Russian Orthodox and quite extensively Russian Orthodox and take it quite seriously, although their churches are pretty full, by the way. Their churches are quite full. Ours are empty, but they've got Russian Orthodox religion to look to. And we've got the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
Oh, don't even get me started on him.
Yeah, indeed. It's not very inspiring, is it? Another one, Jay says, great guest. Thank you very much. I don't know about the World Economic Forum and Russia. That's a difficult question because we're obviously not enmeshed in Russian society, so it's difficult for us to guess at this stuff. There was a theory that Putin was in league with the World Economic Forum and that it's all one thing. It's sort of orchestrated. I don't believe that. I think that this war is genuine and that we're seeing a genuine conflict of between competing interests. I think it's quite real. I think that's all of the questions. Some people did ask about other matters. Here's one. Do you have a comment on the creation of the Ukraine in the first place? It's quite a new country. Why was it created to include the territory that it does? Also, I believe that Khrushchev gifted it Crimea in the mid-50s.
That's really just too long to go into, but I do have, I've just finished, and it's not been put up yet, it's not posted yet, a 40-minute interview with Colonel Douglas MacGregor, who was inside the White House, and he's producing some very, very strong strategic stuff and some great insights. All I can say, perhaps, we did cover this. If you look out for it on my website, and also there's a lot of, there's videos and there's articles on my website which cover this kind of thing in some depth, not as much depth as I suspect you would like, but it will certainly give you a steer on things, my website, if you want to look it up.
Okay. I'm sure that's linked below, so I'm sure people will find it. Then Socracity says, I greatly appreciate the fiery anger in this guest. Thank you, Mr. Bloom. I kept my family from getting the shot, the COVID vaccine. We are all in perfect health. Merry Christmas, and may you have continued good health.
And to you, sir, and to you.
All right. Excellent. Well, this has been great. It was a lot of fun. You're a very dynamic speaker, so thank you for agreeing to appear again.
A great pleasure, and a happy Christmas to all your viewers as well, indeed. And maybe we'll have another chat in a year's time.
Oh, that would be very good.
If I'm still alive.
Okay, well, I certainly hope you are. All right, well, I mean, there's so many things, you know, the climate change and the COVID and all of that might get us by then, who knows, but let's hope not. All right, well, thank you. I'll be back in half an hour with the next guest. But in the meantime, Godfrey Bloom, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial again.
Thank you again.
Okay, see you all later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.